This is The Guardian.
The Tories are still reeling from a devastating set of local election results.
What is the point of this failed government staggering on?
But after days of political coverage, have we really learned why all those losses and gains happened around England? Meanwhile, the Labour Party has welcomed possibly the most right-wing Tory defector in living memory.
Can I also warmly welcome the new Labour MP for Dover?
But under Rishi Sunak, they've abandoned the centre ground and broken many election promises. Meanwhile, under Keir Starmer, Labour have changed.
Is this just another grim punch as Labour chases the final knockout blow? I'm John Harris and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today is The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff. Hello, Gabby.
Hello.
The local elections and mayoral elections and police and crime commissioner elections, let's not forget, last week felt pretty huge to me. We all know there were big Labour advances, there were big Lib Dem advances as well. The Lib Dems, for the first time in a long time, got more council seats than the Conservatives. The Greens are now effectively running the city of Bristol. Keir Starmer did lots and lots of triumphant photo opportunities, and although it was decided that the Tories weren't going to move on Rishi Sunak, he ended up in a pretty awful place. What was your sense of sort of how seismic it was? I felt right. I now know this government is 99% certain to be absolutely finished.
I mean, I do get that, but I felt more boringly as if it was confirmation of what we already knew. I mean, that is what the polls have been telling us for a very long time. It was quite hard to believe, but, you know, so now we've had some conclusive proof that, you know, the polls are right. They haven't made some terrible errors, but we've been seeing those swings in by-elections for a long time. I think what I did get from it is firstly that it's not just increased vote share, it's votes being distributed really efficiently now. So they're winning, not just piling up votes in places where, you know, they've already got seats, but
this is the Labour Party you're talking about.
Yeah, Labour. So you're looking, you know, you're winning in Swindon and Milton Keynes and Lincoln across the West Midlands, places that they actually need to take back. So like that, you know, you can get a landslide on a much smaller swing than we thought. The other thing that I was really struck by, actually, there was all this hype about, oh, was there going to be a move against Rishi Sunak, you know, if he lost badly, which hasn't happened. But I think that to an extent has worked in Labour's favour too. I mean, they've ended up with a sort of wounded opponent that they already know how to beat, limping on only because his party can't decide on who to replace him with. You know, it's not because they sort of rallied behind him, really. And then this very dramatic defection of Natalie Elphick, of all people, to the Labour Party, which we'll talk about in a bit.
We'll talk about her later. But yeah, clearly, Rishi Sunak and his government are even more zombified than they were before this happened. One thing that really bothered me about last week, I think, was that the media coverage, most of it, particularly the broadcast media, felt very, very odd. Every time you saw a result coming through from somewhere, as exciting as dramatic and dramatic as that may have seemed, the analysis of it was just all about what it would mean for Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. And then you had boring, cliched interviews with politicians. So a Tory would be brought on to deny it was as bad as it looked, ridiculously. And then the Labour politician would come on and say they were on the march. And I didn't really get much of a sense of what had actually happened all over England and why. So to sort of fill that gap, really, on Wednesday morning, we rang around a few of the councillors who'd been at the heart of everything.
Well, it was a funny old time, that, because that was just before I came on. So that was...
My name is Councillor John Potter. I am now the Liberal Democrat opposition leader on Preston City Council after a great set of results where we took seats off the Tories and Labour.
So when you were out canvassing... Mm-hmm. What sort of things were the lines that you heard from people time and again? What came up all the time?
I mean, there's the hyper-local stuff. So there's obviously potholes come up loads. The roads are in absolute shambles. So there was that level of kind of, what are we paying for? And particularly with the council tax as well, people are feeling very burdened by the tax, the level of taxes that they have right now. And there's that kind of thing. So, well, why am I paying more for my bin? Why are we paying so much in council tax and the roads are terrible?
Oh, yeah. I know. Are they paying more and getting less, as they see it? Quite right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's no getting away from it. The national picture plays into local politics, as it always does.
And what were they saying about the national picture?
NHS comes up a lot. Cost of living and the state of the economy, the price of food. The overall impression is Britain just isn't quite working. We should be better than what we're getting.
So You took four seats from the Tories and one from the Labour Party, is that correct?
Yeah, over a quite a spread. So from rural villages to suburban areas to urban areas and a three-way marginal. So it was a proper cross-the-board kind of swing we took.
So let's go for the one where there were the most seats to start with. So the ones you took from the Tories.
Yeah.
What do you think was going on there?
I mean, it was brutal for the Tories. I'm not going to say I felt sorry for them because it was good. But one of the wards we took has never, ever been anything but Tory since the inception of local government. I mean, we're trying to figure out the history of it, but it must be like 1835 or something like that. And we absolutely clobbered them. And their vote has dropped from 66% of the vote to nearly 35%.
So it's safe to say, is it, that you know of and you met people who had voted Conservative all their lives, right?
Yeah. I'd been members.
Up to now, through thick and thin, right? And they've chosen 2024 as the time that they're going to stop doing it, at least for now,
yeah,
and vote for someone else.
And some of them you would not describe as liberal. It's a weird thing. They kind of want to punish the Tories. I think they'll eventually go back to the Tories, but it's like almost like a petulant child that needs telling off.
What do they want to tell them off for?
I mean, you can't get away from Liz Truss. No matter what happens, even if they were like really socially conservative, they always had a respect for they could trust the Tories to do right by their money. And as soon as Liz Truss, because we track everything, I'm a complete data nerd, and we can track these figures, and Liz Truss hit, and there it's just absolutely fallen through the floor for the Tories.
Okay, and what did they say about Sunak?
He actually, weirdly enough, he didn't come up loads. I'll be absolutely honest with you. There was a level of sympathy. But also, I think he's had a year now, and I think you had your chance to turn this round, and I think they just think they needed some time out of power, that they're tired,
okay. And
they've got no enthusiasm. And like I say, these people I spoke to, some of them were former Tory members, former Tory activists, all voted Lib Dem in this election because they just wanted to teach the Tories a lesson and in some cases beat Labour.
Wow. You took one seat from the Labour Party?
Yeah.
What was going on there?
Labour have been in council in Preston since 2011, and majority control. And again, people get tired. People are fed up of various things. And that's part of the greatness of democracy, is actually it gives you a chance to renew it. But, I mean, the big one was actually the three-way marginal. But that's where the issue of Gaza came up and really probably hurt Labour, because over the whole city, 4% of ballots ended up getting spoiled, which is massively higher than anywhere else. And there was over 1,000. Many of them had one unique phrase through all of them: no ceasefire, no vote. And it really hurt Labour, and in certain areas of the city, including that three-way marginal.
It sounds like there was a sort of campaign of abstention, almost like it's like a hashtag, yeah, almost, like everyone knew what to write on the ballot paper.
Yeah, it'd clearly been spread between that particular community. People were saying, you know, we forgave Labour for the Iraq war. We can't believe they've let us down again. And it was that kind of, it was a very raw, so I thought it was going to dissipate.
It's fair to say that Preston is pretty solidly Labour in terms of the majority on the council for the Labour Party and so on. You're now the official opposition, right?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
does success look like for you, say in a year's time? On what basis, if you're doing well, will you feel you're doing well?
Effective opposition scrutiny stops horrendous things happening. And you see, when the councils go bust, like we heard one of your previous callers, the first thing that always gets told when it comes out of the review is, where was the level of scrutiny of that council?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did it get to that point? And sometimes I'll be the most unpopular guy in the room scrutinising that Labour council, but that's my job, and that's what I've got to do.
Brilliant.
See you later, guys. Bye.
Yes, Bishopston and Ashley Down.
My favourite part of Bristol, Bishopston. I like yes. hanging around on Gloucester.
Hi, I'm Councillor Emma Edwards, and I'm the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council.
So last week, correct me if I'm wrong, the Green Party went from 24 seats on Bristol City Council to 34 out of 70, meaning that you were tantalisingly close to having a majority. That's still a sizable set of gains from the Labour Party, who elsewhere was sort of on the mark, right? The Labour Party was doing well, but in Bristol it seemed to fall back, right? What was going on, do you think?
There was this feeling of frustration with how Labour have run the city. And that is to do partly with the mayor, partly with some of the policies that had been implemented, just general stalemates in particular situations in Bristol, but also the fact that there's been this oppositional vibe. We have always said from day one, we want us to work together. We don't want this oppositional vibe. We don't think anyone's got a monopoly on good ideas. There's different ward councils, different parts of the city with different opinions. We have to find a way to get on. And that's what basically we've been sort of selling on the doorsteps, and people have been liking that, as well as our policies, and as well as, you know, they like our councillors as well.
So the previous mayor and the Labour Party, as you see it, were guilty of a kind of quite divisive politics as usual that people don't like. And they voted Green in the hope that politics would become sort of more human and outward facing and consensual and nicer, maybe, is one way of putting it.
Yeah.
Do you think there was an unease about the Labour Party nationally?
I think so. I mean, I personally didn't hear that as much on the doorstep. Certain issues did come up, certain issues where people were, you know, turning their back on Labour. I think that's possibly to do with Keir Starmer, feeling that Labour had gone too centre or too far to the right, a lot of disillusionment. I mean, I was speaking to people who had been Labour members for decades and were saying, they weren't saying to me, yay, Greens. They were saying, I'm disillusioned with Labour. What are you offering me? And we were sitting down and having a chat. I think it's a combination of factors, but I think the bigger picture is certainly part of it. And I think local elections are quite indicative of that, where because of first past the post, even if you are a frustrated Labour member, you may not feel like you can vote anything else because it might let the Tories in, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas at a local level, they're already seeing Green councillors in City Hall. They're seeing Green councillors working in their communities. And so that feels like something they can do.
That's quite a big deal, right? I mean, the Greens have run Brighton in the past, right? But running Bristol is one of England's, what, top population-wise and economically, they call it core cities, one of the top 5, 6, 7 councils and cities. So that's a big thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's an exciting thing. It's a very exciting thing. And we're certainly not going to be taking that lightly.
But can you point to one or maybe two aspects of people's everyday lives in Bristol that in a year or two's time you hope will be visibly better?
Buses.
Yes, I agree. As someone who goes to Bristol, a lot, I completely agree.
No, I hope we've started to implement more of our manifesto than that. But that, to me, I mean, I am a transport person. That's my portfolio that I've come from. But on the doorsteps as well, people were like, please sort out the buses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I heartily agree. I've spent far too much of my life on the numbers 8 and 9 trying to get from Temple Mead Station into town. You'll know that feeling.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me, Diane?
I can, yes.
Hi. Dan, just to start, can you tell us who you are and what you did with a lot of your time until last Thursday?
Oh, yes. Hello. Yeah, I'm Councillor Diane Bedford, a Conservative, and I have been a councillor for 22 years, so a long, long time, actually.
Forgive me being blunt, you're not a councillor anymore, is that correct?
No, I'm not, I'm afraid.
Tell me what your sense is or was of the public mood in Farnborough. How do people feel about everyday life, the future, whether politics works or not? What's going on there?
It's a very good question, and I will answer it in my honest way. I don't know the actual answer. I think a lot of people are getting very confused with what was going on. And I think from my point of view, lots of the votes I didn't get were because people didn't know who to vote for, how they felt. I had a lot of people who did say, we would only vote for you. And if we don't, we wouldn't vote for anybody else. So it is quite confusing.
Do you think the government, not just Rishi Sunak, but Liz Truss, Boris Johnson before him, has that got in the way? So is that part of, is what's happened at the top of government part of the reason why you lost your seat?
I think it's government as a whole. I think it's everybody. I don't think they really knew quite what to make of what was going on at any of the parties. Everywhere. It's just that sort of feeling of not specifically us, certainly not locally. Wasn't a particularly good turnout either. So, I think that sort of says it all.
You presumably have been a very dutiful, diligent councillor.
I have.
Maybe you've lost your seat because Conservative politicians in Westminster haven't been up to the job. I mean, I don't know whether you feel at all angry about that.
Disappointed. I don't feel angry because I think, you know, I would have supported, I still do support the Conservatives and all the Conservatives left on the council because I know we'll do our darndest to help. We've always been a good performing council, as you know. So what's happened is something almost like to come out of the box we weren't expecting.
You really weren't expecting it?
No, I don't think we were at all. No, certainly not in this ward for me because I've always had to fight Lib Dems and not Labour, it did come as a bit of a shock that the difference was so great. But I have a huge much amount of faith in our local councillors still here, that they will fight back and hopefully win again. I know they will eventually. So, you know, we just got to get together and recycle, shall we?
Thank you for talking to us. We're very, very grateful.
Okay, thank you.
Gabby, just then you heard the Liberal Democrat councillor John Potter in Preston say that a lot of people spoiled their votes by writing no ceasefire, no vote. And that seems to have lost Labour a seat in Preston. That sort of effect was also evident in terms of people voting for an independent, anti-Labour, Gaza-focused candidate in the West Midlands, among other places. Something happened there, didn't it? That was fairly significant.
Yeah, and in some London wards, and in, for example, you know, Labour losing Longsight in Manchester, these are all, and some close shaves in other bits of Manchester where there's a big Muslim vote, you know, these were all warning signs of something that, again, we've been well aware of for quite a while now, which is that Gaza is really causing a wedge between some, or more specifically, Keir Starmer's position on Gaza is really causing a wedge between him and part of the Labour vote. And I think that's a message the party's got to take seriously. All that said, however, it's mostly costing them votes in areas where, you know, those cities we've talked about where they have pretty whacking great majorities anyway. It didn't stop Sadiq Khan winning in London. You know, if you look at how George Galloway, I'm sure, will have been very disappointed, only to take two seats in Rochdale after all the furor about how, you know, his victory was going to start some kind of nationwide revolution. You know, these are not, at the moment, it is not costing Labour badly at the ballot box. It's more what it's costing them in terms of, I think, goodwill and a general feeling of unease, because there will be people who won't have voted against Labour because of it. You know, they will feel that there are other things that are more important to them, but they're still uneasy about it. And that's a, you know, difficult wicket to go into government on.
So that apart, it seems to me, as I said earlier, that really this points towards one of those seismic once-in-a-generation shifts. It's once-in-a-generation because the Labour Party, in my experience, only wins once in a generation.
Yeah,
completely. Last week, the Conservative MP for Central Suffolk and North Ipswich, Dan Poulter, defected to the Labour Party. He said that the Conservatives were not doing enough to curb the NHS crisis. And this week, on Wednesday, Natalie Elphick, the MP for Dover, defected to Labour. She decried the broken promises, this is a quote, of Rishi Sunak's tired and chaotic government. Now, Natalie Elphick joining a supposedly progressive party of the centre-left is quite something to see, isn't it? She famously said she didn't trust Labour on immigration because they really want open borders. She suggested Marcus Rashford missed a penalty because he was too busy fighting for free school meals. When I Googled Natalie Elphick, the first thing They Work For You came up with was consistently voted for more restrictive regulation of trade union activity. Steve Baker, Brexit hard man, just tweeted, I have been searching in vain for a Conservative MP who thinks themselves to the right of Natalie Elphick. So the Labour Party doesn't have room for Diane Abbott, but it has room for a woman whose views are clearly way right of centre. That's quite something to see.
It now has its first member of the ERG, which I'm sure is very exciting for all concerned.
She's the one woman Labour ERG.
To be fair, it's not just, I mean, Natalie Elphick's political views are sort of somewhere to the right of, I'm not quite going to say Attila the Hun, but not far off. But it's not just that, I think. I mean, she inherited that seat, you remember, from her now ex-husband, Charlie Elphick, who was arrested and jailed for sex offences. And she continued to defend him, not just through the trial, but even after the conviction. And the weird thing about it is she's not standing next time. She's stepping down. So it's not like she's, you know, done a sort of chicken run to Labour so that she could hold the seat as a Labour MP. She's
no, but there is a theory standing. She's done it so she gets a peerage.
She's done it so she gets a peerage, which she's denied. But, you know, I think it'd be very hard for Labour to put her forward for a peerage. But she's one of those defections that you think, you just wanted to be a fly on the wall of, you know, the opposition's office when that offer came in. Because what do you do? Natalie Elphick wants to defect to you. Do you say, no, thanks, we don't want you?
Yeah, you do. Why can't you say that? But hold on, why can't you say that?
Which is one option. And I think in this case, you know, remember we've had, so this is the third defection now, you know, Dan Poulter wasn't particularly controversial, sort of, you know, liberalish doctor with, you know, principled concerns about mental health, you know, could quite easily be accommodated on the Labour side. Christian Wakeford, the Bury MP who defected a couple of years ago, that was more difficult for a lot of Labour MPs because he'd had quite strong right-wing views again. But, you know, he sort of defected in a kind of, you know, I've listened and learned and I don't think that anymore sort of way. But you don't get that from Natalie Elphick. She's saying she defected because Rishi Sunak didn't stop the channel crossings. I mean, it's like, it's just inexplicable. It's kind of baffled everyone involved.
Well, it baffles me in two ways. I don't think it's worth pissing off your own side to this extent. That's one thing. And then the second thing is the signal that it sends probably to a lot of voters. Because a hell of a lot of people I meet say, well, all politicians are the same. And if someone with what you'd think of as clearly defined right-wing views is just able seamlessly to jump into the Labour Party and be welcome, that just sort of underlines the idea that they're all one big blob.
The calculation will have been that what's Natalie Elphick known for? You know, she's known for being tough on immigration. That's why she... That's why Labour MPs find it difficult to welcome her on board, one of the reasons, but it goes with the message that Keir Starmer wants to send. And if he was doing this interview, he would probably be pointing to the fact that, you know, all those positions that the Labour Party instinctively hates on migration or dressing up in the Union Jack or whatever it is this week that you're doing to appeal to sort of slightly right-wing voters, you know, that's what's delivered the results you've just seen in the local elections. That's what gets you a massive swing in Blackpool South. That's what gets you all those things.
Right. That explanation, A, doesn't hold much water, and B, you have a job really extending that to someone like Natalie Elphick.
Well, that explanation does hold water. It's whether or not you've just literally seen it hold water. But the question is whether it applies to Natalie Elphick, and do you have to really kind of embarrass yourself to that extent?
I don't think it holds water at all. I don't think Keir Starmer's awkward sort of hesitant steps into things like going on about how great the Queen is and wrapping himself in the Union Jack have much to do with the fact that Labour is back on the electoral
pitch. I disagree with you fundamentally on that. I think half the government's lost it on economic grounds. But I don't think you win. Sorry, I don't think you do win in places like Blackpool or places like Plymouth. You don't win in those kind of places without having a certain line on the army, the Queen, the, you know, all the rest of it. All of those things that Labour people feel a bit sometimes feel a bit embarrassed by or awkward about or utterly furious about. I don't think you win in those places without sounding a socially conservative note. And people can decide for themselves whether or not they think it's worth it.
But if that's part of your calculation for welcoming Labour's first member of the European Research Group, you could try a sort of reductio ad absurdum argument about where that ends. I mean, why not see if any mates of Richard Tice fancy defecting, you know? See how Nigel Farage is fixed next Sunday. It just looks unseemly and tawdry, and it confirms what some people think of Keir Starmer, which is sort of shapeless and opportunistic. Now, I think there's a lot more going on with Keir Starmer than that. I really do. And I think there's a lot more going on with Rachel Reeves. And I think there's no point in inviting these questions being asked about yourself. It just strikes me as a self-inflicted, unforced error, really.
I agree with you that I don't think there's almost nobody in the Labour Party, I think, who's going to feel massively comfortable sort of sitting next to Natalie Elphick over the next few weeks, or is going to enjoy having Natalie Elphick's, you know, sort of past history chucked back in their faces every time they stand up. I don't think anyone's comfortable with that. I'm not particularly comfortable with that. But, you know, I'm not running the Labour Party.
You're still entitled to an opinion, Gabby. That's why you're here. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. It's worth noting that Today in Focus is doing an episode about Tory defections on Friday. When we come back today, we'll talk about both the Labour and Conservative attempts to somehow get on top as far as the economy is concerned. Welcome back. Something we now hear over and over again from the Tories, it's all over their first batch, as I understand it, of general election leaflets, one of which came through my letterbox this week. It said, the plan is working. That's their great clarion call. That's obviously pretty hilarious to most people, I would imagine, who are paying more and getting less, as I said a moment ago. But the government wants to fight a substantial part of the general election campaign whenever it starts on the economy. And by the end of this week, two things could happen which might convince them that they have a story to tell, I guess. One is that GDP figures will apparently show that the economy has grown and we're out of technical recession. It's not something I hear people talk about now. My local ASDA very often, but that's been punted around as something that may aid the Tories. And then secondly, and this will be something people talk about, the Bank of England could cut interest rates. But obviously, that doesn't get away from the fact that very few people feel life is getting any easier. Most people, when you ask them, in my experience, about the immediate future, and that give you fairly bleak answers. So along comes Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, who was really attempting to break through this sporadic bit of good news, as far as the economy is concerned, by giving a speech in the City of London. Here's a bit of what she said.
The Conservatives are gaslighting the British public. They say we've turned a corner, but try telling that to the 6.4 million households across England and Wales last year who saw their rent increase or who had to remortgage. Or the 950,000 families whose mortgage deal is due to expire between now and January next year.
Her argument was that what the Tories are telling you about the details of your life economically and how that relates to politics is demonstrably wrong. It's incorrect. And there's something almost offensive in the contrast between what the government says and the reality of how people are living, which is a strong pitch, right? We talked about this a moment ago. It's Rachel Reeves' version, really, of saying, come on, look around. You're paying a lot more for a lot less.
It's really interesting. I mean, that's a really kind of quite confident, bold speech, because what it was trying to do was essentially make a preemptive strike. You know, they know Rachel Reeves acknowledged very openly that there might well be better news by the end of this week on both inflation coming down, interest rates potentially coming down, and on coming out of recession or coming out of sort of technical recession. So she was saying, look, you know, what she's trying to do is get in ahead of that and stop the government claiming any credit for that. Stop them saying, oh, look, we're turning a corner now. Because exactly as she said, it doesn't feel that way to many people. And the key line of the speech was the one where she said, we won't have turned a corner until working people feel they are better off. Not just they are better off, but that they feel better off, which is a different way of, you know, it's a different way of putting that. Labour wants to get to the point where if Sunak goes into the election saying, oh, wow, look, you know, we're on the up, they can say, even if that's actually true by the statistics, you know, we are sort of coming out of a sort of slough of despond. They want to be able to say, oh, you know, just goes to show how out of touch he is. It's right for him. He's a millionaire. But do you feel richer? No, you don't.
But that goes back to what I said a moment ago, that even if GDP figures show that we're out of technical recession, they're not talking about that in Asda. That's what I mean, right? I mean, so in that sense, that's a well-taken political point.
It absolutely is. And also, you know, even if economies do start to turn a corner, you don't actually really feel it for a few months after it starts showing up in the statistics. I mean, ironically, it's what happened to Gordon Brown in 2010. Looking back, actually, we were recovering from the crash at that point, mainly, you know, in large part because of some of the decisions the Brown government had taken. But he didn't get the credit for that because people weren't feeling it. All people would remember that was that it'd been awful. You know, they weren't yet feeling the recovery.
There was another interesting thing in this speech, which is that Rachel Reeves was attempting a Labour version of the old Tory tax bombshell argument, relating to this constant Tory talk you hear about getting rid of national insurance altogether. And Rachel Reeves is arguing that that would leave a great big hole in the public finances, which will inevitably be filled by something very, very bad, particularly for pensioners. That's going to be a big part of Labour's election campaigning now, it feels like to me.
It was certainly a big part of the local elections. I mean, they're essentially telling older voters, who are pretty much the last people on earth still voting Tory and reliably large numbers, that the Tories are secretly somehow after their pensions. I mean, it is, to be honest, it is a pretty dirty trick because there's very little evidence for what they're arguing. It's a sort of a similar scare story worked very well for Labour in 1997, you know, that the Tories are coming for your pension, so they're doing it again this time around. This time it's based on, as you said, this argument that Jeremy Hunt said in the budget that there was a sort of vague future aspiration, not just to cut national insurance, but to abolish it altogether, which was, you know, there was no detail about any of that. But anyway, Labour's pounced on it saying, well, that's going to cost you £48 billion. Where's that coming from? Maybe they'll get it from taxing pensioners. I mean, it's very much from the sort of 2 + 2 = 45 school of political attacks. But the point is to tie your opponent up in knots, denying they're not going to do something they're not going to do. And, you know, we've seen it work very well. What's fascinating about it is there's been this long-standing perception, obviously, that under the Tories, old people get all the money and the young get stuffed, you know, and Hunt has tried to sort of consciously rebalance that by cutting national insurance, which obviously only people of working age pay. So it's a tax cut that doesn't benefit pensioners. It's a real sign of Labour's confidence that they've seen the Tories for once in their lives kind of not favouring pensioners and thought to themselves, OK, there's an opportunity for us there. You've left your flank open and we're going after it. And I do think that stuff about abolishing national insurance is going to come back to haunt the Tories in the run-up to the election. It is a bit of an albatross round their necks now.
It's interesting that when I hear members of Labour's economic team asked on news and current affairs programmes the question, okay, well, you're having a go at the government's economic record and you're saying that it's gaslighting people, and that might be a coherent argument, but how policy-wise is your approach to the economy going to be different? They haven't got much of an answer. Now, I don't know at this point in the political cycle whether that's kind of relevant or not. It's enough for oppositions to stand there and convincingly decry the government's record. But the one word that you just hear time and again in response to that is, oh, we'll deliver stability, right? But stability isn't the same as being able to say you will materially improve people's lot in ways A, B, and C. So in that sense, I suppose you can argue there are things missing. But as I say, I'm not sure that counts for that much.
What it's really meant to suggest is just, we're not Liz Truss. You know, we're not going to make mad, stupid decisions that will catch you by surprise, which, you know, is a good thing. I think we're all in favour of that. But it's not, we will not do bad things. It's not in itself necessarily a policy. And it also sets, my reservation about this speech was a little bit that I wonder if there's hostages to fortune in here. The Labour position is, we won't make the same mistakes as the last government. Maybe they won't, but they're going to make some mistakes. Everyone does. And setting themselves up as, it reminds me a bit of, you know, the old Brown, we've abolished boom and bust. Well, you have until it comes back and bites you on the backside. And it's there is a risk to presenting yourself as the sort of godly custodians of the economy who will never get anything wrong, just as there is a risk in promising that, you know, your job is not done till people feel better off. That could take a very long time. Actually, looking at where we are now, that's going to take years. That's not going to happen in 3 months of a Labour government.
Although it probably, going back to the local elections, it probably reflects the most basic difference in voters' perceptions of the two parties right now, which is not about vast political differences and the idea that one's got this set of policies and the other has that. They know what a mess the government's made of things, and they look at the Labour Party and perhaps they think, well, I'll vote for you because at least you're not bonkers. And that's the sort of political calculation that kind of sits under some of what Rachel Reeves said, actually.
I think it is. And it's also why the sort of attack line that the government's now trying to get up, this idea that, you know, the coalition of chaos line being resurrected, you know, the idea that oh, if you vote Labour, you might, you know, there might be a, what if there's a hung parliament and, you know, it all leads to this chaotic coalition. I mean, it's a repeat of what David Cameron did very successfully in 2015. Possibly not a coincidence. David Cameron's currently back in government. When he said, you know, vote Ed Miliband, get the SNP. It worked well then. Firstly, because people were still unsure about Ed Miliband. It sounded plausible that there would be a hung parliament and we'd just come out the back of this very divisive Scottish, you know, independence referendum, and people were scared. Wobbly Tory voters were scared of the idea of the SNP being in government. Would that mean the breakup of the union? But it doesn't work now for two reasons, I think. One is because the minute you say chaos, I mean, the Tories are the chaotic ones now. We've had four years of constant chaos. So that doesn't really work. Secondly, because, you know, the idea that, oh, what will happen if there's a hung parliament? I mean, mate, the polls are showing a Labour landslide at the moment. It's like, you wish this was your problem.
Oh, yeah, but that implies another thing, which is, if you want to increase the chances of a hung parliament, the best thing to do is to vote Conservative. Voting Labour, actually, given the state of everything, poll-wise, and in the wake of these local elections, reduces the chances of a hung parliament. So it founders as far as the most basic reality is concerned.
And I think there's a more fundamental problem, which is, you know, the SNP was quite a good bogeyman in 2015 because some people were really worried about, you know, about this idea of, you know, independence parties, you know, having power at a national level. But realistically, if there was a hung parliament next time, I mean, who would be like the agent of chaos, you know, the sort of chaos monger in this coalition? It would be Ed Davey, you know, Captain Sensible. I mean, the Starmer-Davey coalition. It's so centrist, Dad, it could start its own podcast. I mean, no one's frightened of Ed Davey.
No one has ever before used the term Captain Sensible on this podcast.
We'll be using it a lot in future, I imagine.
Fans of punk rock will know has a slightly different meaning in certain cases, but I'm glad to hear it. Thank you for joining us, Gabby.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, as I always say. Ensure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already, please make sure you listen to Politics Weekly Westminster, the new offshoot of Politics Weekly UK, with Pippa Creerer and Kieran Stacey. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Coutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.